The Second World War, a podcast by Stephen Bedard.
Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/hopesreason. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. In this episode, I have the pleasure of talking with Travis Dow, a prolific podcaster who hosts numerous podcasts, including The History of Germany, which I listen to regularly. Travis brings a tremendous amount of knowledge and energy to the topic. In this episode, we discuss some of what was happening in Germany between the world wars.
In this episode, I have the great opportunity to have a conversation with Travis Dow of the History of Germany podcast and a whole bunch of other podcasts as well. And Travis, could you just introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about what you're doing and how you got involved in podcasting?
Sure. So it's a long question to answer, but I do something like 6 or 7 podcasts altogether. History of Germany is the one that's most relevant right now, and I do it in English and German, and there's 4 episodes now in Arabic, so it's in 3 languages. And I just do 2 of them. I do it in English and German. Then I have a translator, a Syrian refugee in Cairo who translated to Arabic. We started with a podcast on the history of Czech Republic because I lived in Prague in the Czech Republic for 10 years with my co-host, and the history of alchemy, which is kind of history of science, but much more. It really is history of alchemy, and there's something like 80 episodes. If you think that would be a quick topic, or I know we talk about it forever. And we've been podcasting for like 5 years now, and it's just an extension of myself. I grew up in Germany. I grew up in Munich. My dad moved the family there when I was 4, and I lived 10 years in Munich and last time I moved away from Munich, I was 19, so kind of my formative years. And then after college, lived in Czech Republic for 10 years. And now I'm in California for the last 3 years. But it is kind of just like an extension of like, you know, how do I talk about my own life experiences? And I have one podcast I only do in German about the U.S. that's 100 episodes so it's just kind of like, how do I, you know, the people I grew up with, why don't I tell them in German about this place I live now, this crazy place called California? And so it's a lot of, as you well know, it's a lot of fun, and it's a great community, and you meet a lot of people. Both podcasters are an interesting bunch. And of course you connect with listeners that like the topic. I was a ghost tour guide for a while and giving like tours in, you know, the medieval underground of Prague. And I'd have people on the tour from all over the world going, what? Okay, you mentioned this was an alchemist lab from the 17th century, but what is alchemy? Or what, you know, why did they believe you could turn lead into gold? And just researching, you know, wanting to give a better answer is kind of what started it all, you know. So I just started reading, like, oh, that's a good question. Why did they believe that? And, delving into the history of science, and one thing led to another. And, 5 years later, here we are. 5 years later, I just did the math a couple days ago. It's like I'm 430 episodes in all together across 7 shows in the last 5 years. So
wow, that's amazing.
I feel like I've, in a way, I've covered everything. That's of course not true. But, it's like, oh, you know, I'll be watching something or documentary or news, like, oh, I did an episode on that. Yeah.
Well, I thought of you because
biggest one is history of Germany. So,
Well, I had thought about you because we're looking at the background just to the beginnings of the Second World War. And I really wanted to understand where Germany was at that time. And I sent you a list of questions, but before I got there was one other question I wanted to ask you. Now, Nazi Germany described themselves as the Third Reich. And I was wondering if you could just give me like a little Reader's Digest version of what the First and Second Reichs would have been.
Yeah, the main one, like where I am in the History of Germany podcast right now, is the Holy Roman Empire. That would have been, the first one, I suppose. The second one would have been the Prussian one, which goes all the way until the First World War. after that, there's a revolution, and Wilhelm, the last Kaiser, the last emperor, is deposed. And then the Third Reich is not really an empire at all. If you want to imagine Adolf Hitler as an emperor, then that's the Third Reich. So the first one was the Holy Roman Empire.
Okay, that's good. Yeah. That I think
which ended in, for those that, I guess, Napoleon crushed it. That's really when it ended. And then 19th century, the Second Empire started. So that's, yeah, not quite as long lived.
Well, that brings us nicely to the next question I wanted to ask you is, could you give us a quick snapshot of what Germany looked like as it was coming out of the First World War?
That's a very complicated, that's a very complicated question, because there's a lot of cultural things going in that might not be common knowledge, like what were they like in the war, what were they like before the war, but really the end of, so the short version of the answer, I guess, is just try to picture a major, major defeat and a major, major slap in the face to a nation that is kind of like the United States, that's very, very proud. And you know, if you ask an American, we'll tell you we've never lost a war, and, you know, because we don't count Vietnam and all those things. Germany was, you know, the Franco-Prussian War was in memory. In the 19th century, they just won war after war. War with Denmark, another war with Denmark, war against Austria, another war with Austria. Finally, France in 1870, 1871 was a huge victory for Prussia. And, you know, this Prussia, this kind of backwards little tiny kingdom state, unified all of Germany. And, you know, it was just a military miracle in the 19th century. And then fast forward 50 years, and when 40 years, I suppose, and when World War I started, Germans were just gung-ho, just celebrating it was the new generation, and they were just kind of aching to have the glory of their forefathers, okay? Now fast forward 5 years, and you have this vicious defeat, the Versailles Treaty. So if the Germans would have had to actually pay the reparations according to the Versailles Treaty, I don't know if this is true now that I think about it, or some urban legend, but they would have been paying it off until the 80s. I mean, it was really a heavy, heavy reparation. And after World War II, in contrast, we said, let's not do that again, because it was such a slap in the face. It was so humiliating for the whole nation that it was part of the rhetoric of the Nazis, was saying, you know, we need our pride back. We need our, and I don't want to jump ahead, but to paint you a picture that when they were losing the war and it crumbled, revolutions broke out. We have the Soviet Republic of Bavaria, just to give you an example. We have Soviets building, so communists kind of taking over in Hamburg. They were the majority, which was that a very big working class. So, you know, communists taking over the Navy. So the Navy saying, oh, we're done with this war. We're going to sue for peace now on our own as a separate entity. And then by the way, we're going to build a Soviet and be into, you know, it's just surreal, really, all these different things happening at once. But they lose bad and they're humiliated. And instead of rebuilding, they're actually said, nope, you have to get out of the Ruhr area, the most industrial area of Germany, and the French are going to occupy that now. And instead of rebuilding, no, you need to pay the French and the British and so on. And the first thing that happens is just this financial crisis. You get hyperinflation within a couple of years. A loaf of bread goes from costing 1 mark to literally 100 million marks. That's not an exaggeration. A loaf of bread is 1 million marks within a couple of years, and, you know, a dozen eggs would be 1 billion marks. And it's not until 1923 or 1924 when they get the currency reform. So it's hard to actually overemphasize how tough things were. They got defeated militarily, so they were, you know, kind of, things were in ruins, not to compare it to World War II. That's they didn't know that yet, but it, you know, just the worst defeat they've ever had to that point. And then economic crisis, and then, you know, social humiliation, let's say, on the world stage. It took them a couple years to be on the League of Nations, that, you know. So That first glimpse after World War One, to answer your question, is a bleak one. It's depressing, and there's the threat of communism because, you know, Soviet Union is building at this time. Russia is in revolt at this time, and Germany is too. So it's kind of scary for, you know, the rest of the world. And it's the future is uncertain. It's a really hopeless time, I'd say. That's the first picture I'd paint up until, you know, the mid-20s.
Well, I was wondering if you could go a little bit deeper about the fear of communism that was going on. And maybe to tack on to that, before World War II officially breaks out, there is this non-aggression pact with the Soviet Union, which from the outside just seems so unbelievable. How could anyone believe that they could have such a treaty between them when the rhetoric back and forth was so hostile? But I was wondering if you could just touch on that a little bit.
Yeah, let's start there. The Ribbentrop-Molotov agreement was treason. It was just, you know, Germans just considered it like, you know, just taken aback. How could Hitler betray them thusly? Because to the Nazis, to the Germans that were afraid of communists, including the Nazi party members, the people that voted for Nazis. Now, that is kind of jumping ahead a little bit. That's not, you know, that's kind of like the 20s. Hitler joins the party in 21. He becomes the leader of the party in 23. And then that's kind of like it's the same time as the currency reform is 23, 24. Things are looking better for Germany in 23, 24. And it's the same time that Hitler takes control of the party. They rename it the National Socialist Party. And it's hard to imagine that as for us, for in the 20th century, for Canadians or Americans or even Brits to be so loyal to your party in a way that is like so all consuming, because people might know, like, well, why did Nazis have such full power? How did the Gestapo get into your life, you know, your children's life at school? You know, you had to be careful what you said to your kids, because they would go blab stuff to the teachers, and then the next day you'd have the Gestapo knocking at your door. So you're like lying to your children, and you're afraid of what your children could say. And it was just a horrifying time. And people kind of, we don't understand how much control the party had, because we don't live like that. So to rewind a little bit, if you want to look at, take another snapshot of the 20s, let's say, when Hitler takes power and he's the Nazi party, what he's taking power of is one of many, many parties, right-wing parties, and there's the SPD, there's the German Nationalistic Folks, the People's Party, there's the Communist Party, there's also other socialist parties at the time. And this is kind of weird, but so if you're a kid, you already know what party your parents are. Like, it's black and white. It's literally smeared on your T-shirt, because when you go and play soccer, you are playing for the Communist Party, or the, if your dad's in the Communist Party, or the brown shirts, the, you know, if your dad's a Nazi, or the light red party if your dad's in the SPD, which they still exist, the Social Democrats of Germany. And if you join the Boy Scouts, okay, so the Social Democrats would be the Pfadfinder. That's what the Boy Scouts today are still called, the Pathfinders, if you will. The Communists would be the Pionier, like the Pioneers, and that's what they were called in the Soviet Union. That's what they were called in East Germany. That's what they were called in – that's what they're still called in the Czech Republic and some former – and like Poland. They're called Boy Scouts are called Pioneers, because that's the Communist – that was the Communist branch. And if your dad was a Nazi, then of course you joined Hitler Youth. And, you know, we have records of like kids coming home and be like, oh, I want to be a Hitler Youth kid, because they get the cooler uniforms, or they get the knife. You know, and I want the knife. And then the dad's like, no, you don't, you know, like, let me explain why, you know, Nazis are evil and all that. So you have that kind of thing happening. It's from the soccer team that your 5-year-old child is playing in, to when he joins Boy Scouts at like 10, to what bars you go to It's by political party. You don't drink. You don't drink with, like, when we say that our social media, we live in a bubble and there's Republicans and Democrats and we don't get what the other side is going on. That was no different in the 1920s in Germany. You read, if you're a communist, okay, you read communist newspapers, or if you're a social democrat, you read social democrat newspapers. There was, you know, the media, the newspapers was by party. And then you went to bars where you'd be surrounded by the music of your Nazi friends or your communist friends or whoever you were. You would go to the bars where the like-minded people hung out. If, you know, you join unions. So chances are if you were worked at this factory, you would join this union. They would either be a little right-thinking and be a Nazi union, or they'd be a communist union, or, you know, most of them were kind of socialist or communist unions. Not necessarily. There was right-wing unions as well, workers' parties and such. So that's the one thing. Okay, so when Hitler signs a pact with, you know, fast forward 10 years, okay, because you're really talking like all parties are outlawed. The only thing you can do as a child is be Hitler Youth. The only thing you can vote for is the Nazi Party. That didn't happen until, you know, 33, 34, 35. So that's like 10 years, you know, fast forward 10 years, skip the whole 20s now. But then when Hitler did sign a non-aggression pact with Stalin, that was crazy, yes, but it totally makes sense for Hitler. Hitler was, and it totally makes sense for Stalin. Hitler, ironically, if you want to, like, you know, really get a deep dive into who Stalin was, he was a dictator. He was a, you know, cult of personality. He was a megalomaniac, kind of whatever label you want to give him. He didn't trust anybody in the planet. It doesn't matter what you, if you think he was left or right, whatever label you want to give him politically, what he was a dictator. Okay. It doesn't matter what party he assigned himself to. That doesn't matter. And Hitler, the same could be said. Hitler would, if he went to this speech, Hitler knew who his audience was, when he rose to power. And if he would go talk to, a board of executives and try to get money for, you know, kind of like, you know, you talk to big capitalists. In that case, he would tailor his speeches to them. And then he'd go to a bar with, you know, lower class, working class men. He would tailor their speeches to them. And then he would go talk to a certain community and just, you know, spout anti-Semitic stuff that had nothing to do with anti-communism or, you know, pro-worker rights or whatever. So just depending on who he talked to, because Hitler was also a opportunistic dictator. And honestly, Hitler and Stalin were two peas in the same pod from personality point of view, from, you know, from many, many points of view. And this is a pretty, you know, not too many historians would argue this fact, which is, or this belief, which is that the only person on this planet that Stalin truly, truly deep down trusted was Adolf Hitler. There is no one that a man like him could trust than another murdering, you know, mass murdering megalomaniac like himself. It makes perfect sense. But to the normal person on the, you know, that didn't make sense to the rhetoric. The people reading the newspaper, from the Russian point of view, Hitler was evil. He was Satan. And from the German point of view, Stalin was evil incarnate, the enemy, you know, capital E. So from the people on the streets point of view, it was crazy. It was insanity. In fact, this didn't just blow people's mind in the Soviet Union or Germany. A little known fact is that the Communist Party of the United States, the Communist Party of America, lost something like over 100,000 or hundreds of thousands of members the day the news came out of the Ribbentrop-Molotov Treaty.
Interesting.
So American communists just lost faith because in Germany they would flock to the Communist Party because they were anti-Hitler, or they would flock to the Nazi Party because they were afraid of Stalin. So it was very polarizing. You know, and that's a way that, you know, that was part of the rhetoric was watch out this, you know, the Russian bear, this beast, this mighty, mighty beast to our east. We have to protect against it. And the person most capable to do so is, you know, Nazis said, Adolf Hitler. So in the next election, vote for Hitler because he was the anti-communist bastion. So, yeah, you know, it was mind-boggling for them to sign a treaty. But for Hitler's point of view, of course, he wanted to focus on France and the UK, And didn't want to have to worry about Stalin. And Stalin was just super happy to not have to mobilize immediately because he had an industrial crisis to deal with and didn't want to have to put all his industry into tanks and, you know, mobilization if he didn't have to. So it was, yeah, of course, the two evil dictators, it makes perfect sense. But it did not, yeah, it didn't make sense to their rhetoric. It was treason on both sides.
Well, this gets a little bit outside of the German context, but Churchill was pretty strong with his rhetoric against Stalin before that, really saw the evil of Stalin. But when it came down to needing a strong ally against Germany, he was definitely willing to work with them. Yeah, mm-hmm. You'd have to do what you have to do, I guess, in certain circumstances. Now, you've talked a bit about how the communists were blamed and a lot of the finger pointing that was going on there. Nazi Germany is often thought of in terms of anti-Semitism, but they definitely weren't the ones who introduced it into Germany. I was just wondering if you could give some of the context of how anti-Semitism sort of developed and maybe how Hitler was able to build upon that.
From like the very earliest idea of Christianity, just saying, just reading the Bible and saying, you know, it was Jews that killed our Messiah. It was Jews that killed our Savior. But then you also add the whole, so that's just kind of like some one concept, but then you add a whole bunch of layers of, BS, sorry, if you will, on top of that, which is like things like blood libel, like the, I don't know, like how much common knowledge this is, but in medieval times, it wasn't just anti-Semitic reasonings for the sake of because they killed Jesus or because they refused to acknowledge the light and convert to Christianity or anything. No. There was additional things added on to this. Like they were this kind of because they were the chosen people. They were this kind of mystical. They had these mystical properties and that in turn might have been kind of evil. Like maybe they were in tune with the devil. And there was these stories of like what blood libel is that they would sacrifice a Christian child to Satan to get these magical properties. And you know, every once in a while, someone would just point at this, you know, wealthy Jewish family. And there weren't many. Most Jews lived in poverty and in fear of their lives, you know, since the Crusade times, pogrom times and whatnot. But you might point to a wealthy Jew now and then and say, oh, he has that because he sold his soul to the devil. No, you know, Jews were the only bankers. They were the only ones that were allowed to commit usury, demand or ask for interest. Like Christians, you know, good Christians wouldn't ask for interest, but Jews were allowed to do that. And so they, you know, that was then held against them. If you owed too much money, then a good way to get around that was just, talk people up into a pogrom and wipe out everybody's debts in town. And as horrible as that sound, you know, the first time the plague rolled around, blame the Jews. The first time the Crusades, when people talk them up into religious fervor and you're saying, oh, heretics are burning the holy sites in Jerusalem. Well, look, there's heretics right in our hometown, those stubborn Jews that won't convert. So there was these medieval ideas. Then you add nationalistic ideas of the 19th century. So again, this is pre-Nazi days. And in the 19th century, you have, listen, you know, I live in France. Hence, I'm a Frenchman. What does that mean? That means I'm Catholic. That means I voted for the president. That means, this and that and the other thing. Or I'm German. That means, I pay taxes to the Kaiser. That means I was born in Bavaria. And that means this and that. And that means I'm Catholic or Lutheran. You know, Martin Luther, a known anti-Semite, is nothing. There's nothing more like Prussian than to be Lutheran. To be Lutheran equals being Prussian. It's part of your identity. So if you're in Berlin, let's say, and you're Prussian, you're Lutheran, or you're in Paris, or you're in London and you're English, you know what an Englishman is. You know, it's you speak English, you're Anglican, and God save the King, King George or whatever. What doesn't fit is that Jew over there, because he's not French, is he? He's not Catholic like me. In fact, if you're in Germany, he speaks German a little funny because he has a Yiddish accent maybe, or he speaks Yiddish. So the point is, he sticks out. He's not one of us. He's not, you know, he's not you and me. He's not Canadian or American. He's got those curly hairs and he wears the funny hat. He's one of them. He's different. So when you get the ideas of nationalism in the 19th century, you also get a new look at anti-Semitism and new reasons to hate Jews. Well, Nazis, you know, they're very nationalistic. That's in their title. But you get more ideas in the 19th century. You get ideas of genetic superiority, of euthanasia and eugenics, especially eugenics and phrenology. These are a lot of terms you'd have to go back and define. But like, you know, phrenology is like the shape of your skull identity. So, and these are there would be problems in school. To fast forward to Nazi days, imagine you're a student and you're like 10 years old and here's your math problem, you know, a person in a sanitarium, like someone that has a physical handicap or someone that's mentally disabled, let's say, they cost the state or they cost the taxpayer so-and-so much money. There are so-and-so many disabled people in Germany. How much money could we save if there were no disabled people? Okay? And you give that math – it's just – that's your math homework. Okay? Or your biology lesson is Slavic peoples procreate at this and this much, you know, rate per couple. Germanic, you know, Aryans, they would say, Aryan, you know, superior people are procreate at a much lower rate. And then, you know, so in 50 years, what will the population of Russians versus Germans be? That's a math problem for kids, trying to get you afraid of Slavs, trying to get you to think, wait a minute, if there were no handicapped, you know, people with disabilities, you know, trying to, it's just like, it's surreal. But then you get to anti-Semitism and you know, I mean, I've seen the textbooks, you know, you see the phrenology is like they would measure the length of the nose, the distance that sticks out from the face, the length of the forehead, the slant of the forehead. All of these would be characteristics of lesser people with lesser morals, lesser virtues, just, you know, total quackery and pseudoscience. But this is what we're looking at in the turn of the century and, you know, coming out of the 19th century into the 20th century, this was it's still pseudoscience even then, but this was it was mainstream and this was what Nazis were funding. And of course, when Nazis came to power, this is what scientists had to kind of toe the line if they wanted to keep their jobs. Jews were obviously banned from being professors and whatnot. So this sort of science took over. So when you ask the question, okay, where did that come from and how did they – Nazis didn't invent anti-Semitism. It has a good 1,000 years of tradition. I'm about to do an episode on Yiddish, which, you know, comes back to, you know, the 12th century, 13th century when Jews were so segregated that – like I've been to the Ukraine. I've been a Yiddish translator, you know, interpreter. I'm trying to speak to people that speak Ukrainian, trying to, you know, help my Jewish friends find their long lost relatives. And I'm not Jewish and I don't speak honestly, like officially, I don't speak a lick of Yiddish, but I do though, because I grew up in Bavaria and Yiddish, I would say Yiddish is kind of a Southern German dialect, like a lot of Austrian in it, with Hebrew words mixed in that I do not understand. But I've been able to, you know, communicate in it before, but it's German. It is German. It's a German language, but it's so different because they've been secluded for 1,000 years. And the fact that Jews have their own dialect is it's a traumatic piece of evidence that they were so secluded in their ghettos. That's where the word comes from. The ghetto was the first ghetto was the Jewish district in Venice. If you know, I mean, how many wormholes do you want to go down here? Like they were discriminated against for 1,000 years plus. For 2,000 years, really, but by Germans for 1,000 years, by Europeans for 1,000 years, and because there's only been Germans for 1,000 years. So since Germans' beginning as a Christian state, they've been anti-Jewish, and they've had Jews as their neighbors. So Nazis, you know, that's a complicated one. Now, Nazis, of course, went to just their own logical extreme and, you know, saying, well, we're just wasting time and money trying to deal with this. The only solution is a final one where we, you know, terminate all of them basically. And so they had their own, you know, they brought their logic, they squashed out all opposition and all counter opinions, and they taught it in school and they taught it in publicly, and it was in the press and the newspapers, and famous Jews were defamed and, you know, humiliated and forced to flee or, you know, killed if they didn't flee in time in the 30s. They were killed in the 40s. And, you know, how much time do you got? I mean, that is you could go down more rabbit holes of how Nazis then really took it to us, to an art of filling the universities with people trying to further vindicate themselves and explain why Jews are bad and Aryan Germans are great. And, you know, it's total quackery and pseudoscience. But it was in the, you know, universities in Munich and Berlin was taught.
That's really helpful, I think, to give us the background of where it was coming from, because I'm sure that there are a lot of people who think that the Nazis just jumped in and introduced this when it was really a part of the culture for centuries and centuries before that.
Now, and not just German cultures. It would be stupid. It would be so naive to think that wasn't happening in the U.S. or mm-hmm. England or France or Spain or Italy. Or Russia or the Ukraine. I'm just thinking of places I know of specific pogroms, or like in the U.S., you know, Henry Ford was a contemporary of Hitler, and Henry Ford was just as anti-Semitic as Hitler was. Henry Ford was one of Hitler's heroes, actually. You can talk about the VW and all that, you know, just copying Henry Ford's ideas, because Henry Ford also hated Jews, and Hitler appreciated that.
Wow.
So it also happened here. It's, you know, we turned away Jewish refugees. We, I mean, Canadians too, but, yes. But Americans also. And, you know, so it's, yeah, I think that's important to point out too, is that now in retrospect, we kind of like look at what happened in the Holocaust, and it's kind of like, oh, wow, that, you know, and you kind of look back in shame and, you know, wondering what people could have done different. And the answer is a lot. And even Americans could have, and French and Swiss certainly could have helped more. And it's just hard to fathom how deep anti-Semitism has been in, you know, over the centuries, and just part of any place you'll find Christians, I guess, you'll find anti-Semites as well.
Yes, yeah, very. It's a very unfortunate part of our history, and even thinking about subjects like eugenics, to know that they didn't come up with that was something that was happening in the United States before the war as well.
Oh yeah,
so, yeah, yeah. If you had to pinpoint something as to the reason why Hitler was able to rise to power, where would you want to place your bet?
So actually, I kind of have a little pet theory. So the thing is, of course, without spending 5 hours answering that, I would be oversimplifying, and I will oversimplify. But it is because it's such a perfect storm. Like, there is no one answer. There is no one answer. There was why Hitler? Why not a different right wing party? There was dozens of right wing parties. Hitler's was not the biggest. It wasn't the most influential. It slowly edged out others. How did it do that? You know, in the 20s, while Al Capone was shooting up Chicago, you know, South Central with Tommy guns, Hitler and the brown shirts were shooting up the streets of Berlin and Munich with automatic pistols and such. It's amazing. They were, even in the 20s, they were wearing the same clothes. You like fedora hats and, you know, suits and such. The uniforms came a bit later. It's like if Capone went political instead of gangster, you know, it's just, there's parallels, just like the street thug attitude. The SA was banned. And then in 24, 25, maybe it was later, maybe it was 28, 29. I don't remember. The chancellor at the time legalized the SA again, which was really the enforcer group of the Nazis. There's the SS, the SA, that, you know, and then the SA was later purged when they got to power. But so that's really the thuggish branch. They went around on voting, you know, to voting booths and beat up the opposition. So it's very, you know, anti-democratic property, you know, practices just open on the streets. So that's one thing is, yeah, they, you know, they bullied their way to get the votes. Okay. But that doesn't answer everything, because the first successful election was a free election, and they got like 18%, which is scary, by the way, because the AfD, which is a Nazi party in Germany, just got 14%. So that, I mean, that made me like, that almost gave me a panic attack. That just happened like a couple days ago.
Oh my goodness.
We're living in scary times again, by the way. But the last free election, Hitler got something like 38%. So you don't get that many votes from just being a thug. You know, there's more going on there. So what is going on? Okay. Now, the thing is that what people might not realize is that Germany also had the – what people do realize is that people – that Germany had the Roaring Twenties. They called it the Goldene Zeit, like the golden time, the golden age. They had the gilded times of where you have like cabaret in Berlin and, you know, jazz and American musicians, you know, touring Berlin. They had a very prosperous time. What you don't realize is the chancellor in 21 to 23 kind of when he got serious about currency reform. Remember, this was the time I said that a loaf of bread would cost you a million marks. So they had to pay you. They had to pay your salary every day because the next day, you know, they would have to pay you 10 times more because it was just worthless. Whatever they paid you the previous day, they'd have to pay you, and you'd have to run to the store and buy your eggs and bread. And within hours, whatever you had would be meaningless. You'd have to have three times as much. So it was just a horrible time. So what did this guy do? He did currency reform and he started to give people confidence. Well, wait a minute. You don't just magically give people confidence. What did he actually do? Let's peel this onion a little bit. And this is something that I haven't heard a lot in a lot of podcasts. So, I'd appreciate it if people went into this a little bit more, like as the cause of Hitler or the cause of the Third Reich is the golden age of the 20s was a bought golden age. It was not a real one with real economic values. The Versailles Treaty, they still had to pay reparations. And while they were having this boom, they were paying all this money to France and England, and they didn't really have that money. And the reason they could even, in the first place, give people some confidence to say, okay, Germany's going to be okay again economically, and you can have confidence in us, you can invest in Germany again. And they joined the League of Nations again, and, you know, things kind of calmed down, was because they mortgaged – the chancellor straight up mortgaged off all of Germany's assets, okay, to American banks, no less, for the most part, American banks. No other banks had capital. It's not like American banks are evil at the time. It's just that the French and the British were broke from fighting World War One. And the Americans actually financed with a loan, with interest, they financed the Germany's reform, but at a price. They mortgaged off the railroads, all the factories, all actual assets, all states, you know, massive amounts of land. And so it seemed like Germany was doing okay, and for about 5 years they were. Okay, American banks now own all of Germany's assets. Cool. Well, wait a minute. Oh, wait. Okay, that happened in 1924. Fast forward 1929. What happened in 1929? The stock market crashed in New York. American banks are suddenly not doing so well, and they want to call in their mortgages. Germany has basically a stock market crash or a complete run on the bank and an economic collapse basically the next day. The whole world does. We cause a chain reaction globally, like in the Western world. So that's it. Now, okay, so that's 29. Hitler basically comes to power within 4 years. By 31, he gets 18% and they're in parliament and he's running part of the country already. By 33, he's, you know, through emergency – that's it. He's chancellor, and then through emergency measures, he shuts down all the competition. Within three – you know, he marches into Austria within a couple of years. He marches in Czechoslovakia, and that's the beginning of the end. So it's this what I want to say is, really, if you peel that onion all the way down, Germany never did recover from World War One. They just pretended for 5 years by holding all their – by mortgaging off all their assets. After 5 years, the bubble burst, and that was that. And they were back to, you know, post-World One hyperinflation. In comes Adolf Hitler with him saying, you know what's a bad idea? Versailles Treaty reparations. That was unfair and we should stop that. Well, that gets a lot of attention and a lot of votes. And saying demilitarization, maybe that's a bad idea. Maybe we should break that treaty. And maybe we should march back into our most industrial part of Germany, which is the Ruhr area, which France was occupying. And it's just, you know, how are you going to pay back France if France is also occupying your breadbasket? The Ruhr, you know, the area around Essen, Cologne, Dusseldorf, that part of Germany is like – that's where all the mining happens. All the coal comes from there, all the iron, and then all the industry, all the steel, all the – you know, all the actual appliances and cars and everything. And that's where the Rhine comes through. So if the French take away the Rhine, they take away Germany's highway. So that it was just too much to bear. And Hitler saying, it's unfair and let's take it back legally or illegally. We don't care. You know, Germany's proud and strong and we can be proud and strong again. Make Germany great again, if you will. I don't know what kind of listeners you got that might make some angry, but it was really that kind of rhetoric. It was like, you know, we could do better. And there were, you know, there was time. He was hearkening back to Bismarck, and there was a lot, you know, Hindenburg was the president and Hindenburg was there in Bismarck's time. And, you know, so you see this, the Pickelhaube, which is the word for that spiky Prussian helmet. And in 1933, 1934, there's a famous picture of Hindenburg shaking hands with Hitler, and they're both in uniform. You know, you see the old guard and the new guard, you know, Hitler's snazzy Nazi uniform, the modern looking thing, and, you know, the old Pickelhaube and the imperial Prussian uniform. And, you know, it's very symbolic, and it wasn't lost on anybody. That Hitler was getting the old Prussian pride back, you know, one way or another. And let's face it, that, you know, that got votes. If you had a really tough time for a couple of decades, you know, you're still reeling. World War One was just a couple of decades, you know, previously. So that's living memory. They lost a whole generation. You have a whole generation of people with limbs missing. You know, it's on the street. You go to the bakery and you see some guy with half his face gone from trench warfare or missing an arm and a leg from fighting the French. And, you know, it's just, you see that every day, that never went away. Unfortunately, you know, they didn't learn the lesson that war isn't the answer and war sucks. And honestly, just objectively speaking, you know, not defending Hitler or anything, like heaven forbid, but the Versailles Treaty was unfair. You know, we didn't make that mistake again, ever again. We've never made that mistake again. We've always retried to, even if we don't do it very well, like in Afghanistan or Iraq, every time we defeat somebody, we pump billions of dollars into it and try to rebuild the nation, because we know that Versailles getting revenge on the loser and saying you started World War One, you pay for World War One, that doesn't work. And in World War Two, we basically rebuilt their whole economy. So that's, yeah, I mean, so they were just reeling, you know, it's just, they never recovered. It was just a traumatic time to be in Germany, and they only had 5 years when things seemed okay. And then the bubble burst, and then Hitler just rose to power like a bubble in water. I mean, he just floated right to the top in a weird kind of sweeping, you know, military – or I mean, just not a military coup, just a you know, democratic coup at first. But, oh, yeah, one that's been talked about and studied ever since, because it's just, yeah, fast.
Well, yeah, that sounds quite plausible, what you've presented. I think that makes a lot of sense. Well, that's great. I really appreciate you taking this time, Travis, to give us some of the background, what was happening in Germany between the wars. Where can I send some people to learn more from you? What websites would be best for them to see what you're doing?
I'd say just come by podcastnik.com. That's podcast, N-I-K. .com, kind of like Sputnik, you know, because I lived in Czech Republic, but Podcastnik is actually, it could be Russian for podcaster, but podcastnik.com, all my shows are linked to from there. And on Twitter, I'm at podcastnik.com. And to your listeners, I'd like to say that, yeah, there's a bunch of Facebook groups out there where we can hang out with history podcasters. And to you too, you know, come hang out with us on like History Podcasts Facebook group or the Agora Listeners group. Those are mostly history podcasters and history podcast listeners. So a lot of like-minded folks and great community on Twitter, on Reddit. There's a History Podcasts subreddit and all that. Yeah, there's a lot of like-minded folks out there that'll, if you want to hear more and keep in touch, please do.
Well, it's a great time to be interested in history, because we can learn a lot from each other in such easy and accessible ways. So thanks a lot, Travis. Really appreciate that.
My pleasure. Yeah, thanks for having me on.
My recommendation for this episode is William Shire's Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. Since its publication in 1960, William L. Shire's monumental study of Hitler's German Empire has been widely acclaimed as the definitive record of the 20th century's blackest hours. The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich offers an unparalleled and thrillingly told examination of how Adolf Hitler nearly succeeded in conquering the world. With millions of copies in print around the globe, it has attained the status of a vital and enduring classic. To download your free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/hopesreason. Again, that's audibletrial.com/hopesreason for your free audiobook. Thank you for listening to this episode. Come and visit me at secondworldwarpodcast.net, at facebook.com/secondworldwarpodcast, and on Twitter at www2_podcast. Thank you, and God bless.